What happens when a 3-year-old witnesses his sister's abduction? How does a grandmother's chair propped against the bedroom door shape a little girl's lifelong fears? These aren't just difficult stories. They're windows into how our brains physically change in response to early experiences. What Happened to You has become Oprah Winfrey's most profound book project, reaching #1 on the New York Times bestseller list and being hailed by mental health professionals as revolutionary in its approach to understanding behavior. The collaboration between Oprah and renowned neuropsychiatrist Dr. Bruce Perry transforms our understanding of trauma from "What's wrong with you?" to the more compassionate and scientifically accurate "What happened to you?" Through their conversations, they reveal how childhood experiences, both good and bad, literally shape our developing brains and influence every aspect of our lives. Our brains develop from the bottom up, with the most primitive areas forming first in the womb and the sophisticated thinking centers developing last. This sequential development creates vulnerability. Early trauma affects the foundation upon which all later development builds. Dr. Perry explains that our brains create code books of associations based on our experiences, particularly during sensitive developmental periods. These code books become the lens through which we interpret the world. Consider Samuel, a 14-year-old boy who had protected his younger siblings from their alcoholic father before being placed in residential care. Despite making progress, Sam had inexplicable violent outbursts with his new male teacher. The mystery was solved when Dr. Perry discovered the teacher wore Old Spice cologne, the same scent Sam's abusive father used to mask alcohol. This sensory trigger activated Sam's trauma response without his conscious awareness. These associations form at multiple brain levels. While our cortex stores narrative memories, on Monday, the boyfriend yelled, lower brain regions store physiological responses, like increased heart rate and muscle tension. These stored responses can be triggered later by sensory cues associated with the trauma, a certain tone of voice, a particular smell, or even the time of day. This is why trauma's effects can seem so mysterious. A person might react strongly to something seemingly innocuous because their brain has detected a pattern similarity to past danger. Their lower brain regions sound the alarm before their thinking brain can evaluate the situation rationally. Understanding this biological reality helps us see that many problematic behaviors are actually adaptive responses to perceived threats, responses that once kept someone safe but may no longer serve them well. Our bodies constantly work to maintain balance, a process called homeostasis. When pushed out of balance, our stress response systems activate in different ways. The familiar fight or flight response increases heart rate and pumps adrenaline, focusing attention on threats. But when fighting or fleeing isn't possible, especially for small children, dissociation becomes the adaptive strategy. Heart rate decreases, natural opioids release, and the person psychologically retreats to their inner world. The pattern of stress activation is crucial. Consistent, predictable, nurturing parenting creates resilient stress response systems, while chaotic activation leads to sensitization and dysfunction. Children raised with unpredictable stress develop hypersensitive alarm systems that can be triggered by minor stressors throughout life. This explains why addiction is often self-medication for developmental trauma. People with histories of unpredictable stress develop sensitized stress response systems, creating what Russell Brand called an internal storm. When introduced to substances, they may experience a calm they've never known before. The pleasure from relief of distress becomes powerfully rewarding. Every day, people need to fill their reward bucket through various sources: relationships, activities aligned with values, or substances. While healthy relationships provide the most sustainable reward, those with trauma histories often turn to less healthy options when disconnected from supportive relationships. Gloria's story illustrates this perfectly. Having grown up in foster care without experiencing love, she struggled with addiction and lost custody of her 3-year-old daughter, Tilly. Under the guidance of Mama P, a nurturing foster mother who recognized Gloria needed as much love as her daughter, both began to heal. Gloria initially showed love through giving candy, the only way she knew how. and with support rather than punishment, she developed better parenting skills. This demonstrates neuroplasticity, the brain's capacity to change with experience, including the neural networks that enable us to love. With proper support and loving experiences, even those who were never loved can learn to become loving. To infants, love is an abstract but tangible action, the attentive, responsive care provided by adults. When caregivers consistently respond to a baby's needs, they build the foundation of the organizing brain. These thousands of loving interactions create the resilience-building pattern where stress is followed by regulation. Through these experiences, children develop their worldview about whether people are good and trustworthy. The capacity to love is built through being loved, as these interactions grow the neural networks that allow us to feel and express love. This relational capacity is fundamental to human survival, as Dr. Perry calls love relational superglue that keeps our species alive through community connection. The quality of early relationships literally shapes brain architecture. Perry uses the metaphor of building a house. Foundation in fetal development, framing in early months, wiring and plumbing in the first year. If early development has defects, like shoddy wiring in a house, problems emerge later despite superficial appearances. Love requires being present, attentive, attuned, and responsive, abilities shaped by our early experiences. Powerful connections happen in small, fully present moments, like Kate's middle-of-night Cheerios with her dying mother. Without these nurturing moments, a child's neural networks don't organize properly, creating vulnerability throughout life. This is why trauma in early childhood can be so devastating. When children experience unpredictable threat and chaos during critical development periods, they may become permanently stuck in fear states. This maladaptive response causes hypervigilance, mistaken for ADHD, resistance, labeled as oppositional defiant disorder, and fight or flight behaviors that lead to school suspension or assault charges, highlighting the critical need for trauma-informed systems that ask what happened to you rather than what's wrong with you. Trauma is fundamentally subjective. What traumatizes one person may not affect another. Using a school fire example, Dr. Perry illustrates how the same event creates different outcomes. A first grader develops a sensitized stress response system, true trauma, while a fifth grader experiences only temporary stress activation before returning to baseline. The SAMHSA's 3E's definition of trauma, event, experience, effects, acknowledges this complexity. Trauma can arise not only from obvious events like physical abuse, but also from quieter experiences like emotional abuse or marginalization. The specific health effects depend on genetic vulnerability, developmental timing, previous trauma history, family trauma history, and the buffering capacity of healthy relationships. The groundbreaking 1998 Adverse Childhood Experiences Study used a 10-item questionnaire to measure childhood adversity, revealing correlations between higher ACE scores and increased risk for the 9 major causes of death, suicide, mental health problems, and substance abuse. While revolutionary, Perry notes the study has limitations. It used a predominantly white, middle-class sample, included only 10 adversities, and is often misinterpreted as showing causation rather than correlation. Perry emphasizes that ACE scores indicate probability, not certainty. Many people with high ACE scores are healthy and productive, while some with low scores struggle significantly. The score fails to capture critical factors like timing, pattern, and intensity of stress, or the presence of buffering relationships. Perry's own research reveals two crucial findings. First, relational health, connectedness to family, community, and culture, is more predictive of mental health than adversity history. Second, the timing of adversity dramatically affects outcomes. Trauma in the first 2 months of life has more devastating effects than trauma experienced later. Healing from trauma happens through brief, controlled moments rather than extended sessions. A traumatized 3-year-old boy became overwhelmed when his father tried discussing his mother's murder at length, rocking, moaning, and fleeing. This demonstrates how trauma processing must be carefully paced, as overwhelming emotions activate stress responses that shut down higher brain functions. Instead, healing comes through thousands of brief therapeutic moments where the person feels safe and in control. Oprah shares a personal trauma story about her grandfather attacking her grandmother at night, which left her with a lifelong fear of being home alone. This experience taught her how connecting traumatic events to current behaviors can be healing. Dr. Perry explores how fear and trauma can be transmitted across generations through multiple pathways. While specific fears aren't genetically inherited, they are transmissible through emotional contagion, observation, and direct teaching. Children absorb the emotions, beliefs, and values of those around them, particularly their caregivers, and these transmissions shape their developing brains. Epigenetic changes occur when environmental factors turn genes on or off without changing the DNA itself. During starvation, the body sends chemical signals to activate dormant genes to use resources more efficiently. Similarly, trauma can trigger epigenetic changes that can be passed through generations. An enslaved person's adaptive stress responses could be transmitted to descendants, potentially creating children born with stress systems already primed for threat, even when that threat no longer exists. The encouraging news is that these epigenetic changes are reversible. Just as trauma can create these changes, nurturing relationships can reverse them, as our bodies continuously adapt to stay in balance with our environment. This explains why trauma patterns often run through families. Children don't just inherit genetic material, they inherit patterns of interaction, stress responses, and worldviews. Breaking these cycles requires understanding how these patterns developed in the first place, which is why the question, "What happened to you?" is so powerful. It allows us to see behaviors not as character flaws, but as adaptations to experiences, adaptations that can be modified with new healing experiences. Our brain processes experiences sequentially, with lower regions responding to sensory input before higher regions analyze it. This creates problems when past trauma gets triggered, like Mike's brain matching motorcycle backfires to war sounds, or Oprah's nighttime solitude triggering memories of her grandfather's attack. The brain can't tell time, so it reacts as though past traumas are happening now. When communicating with others, our ideas must travel from our cortex through the lower brain's emotional filters before reaching another person's cortex. This creates many opportunities for distortion, especially when someone is dysregulated and their cortex is partially shut down. Dr. Perry illustrates the sequence of engagement through his work interviewing Joseph, a 3-year-old who witnessed his sister's abduction. By carefully managing the power differential, using brief, repeated interactions to build safety, and getting physically on Joseph's level, Dr. Perry established enough regulation and connection that Joseph could access his cortical memory and identify his sister's murderer. The sequence, regulate, relate, then reason, proves essential for effective communication in any context. When a person is in a fear state, dysregulated, higher brain areas like the cortex experience a partial shutdown, making it difficult to access narrative memory. A common example is test anxiety. The information is stored in memory, but retrieval becomes impossible in the moment due to stress. However, when someone feels regulated, connected, and safe, stored memories become accessible and easier to retrieve. This principle explains why traditional talk therapy often fails with severely traumatized individuals. Sitting in an office discussing painful experiences can activate stress responses that shut down the very brain regions needed for processing. More effective approaches begin with regulation through rhythm, movement, and safety before attempting verbal processing. The journey from coping to healing requires understanding how different types of trauma manifest. Thomas and James, 2 12-year-old boys with identical diagnoses but vastly different presentations, illustrate this perfectly. Thomas, despite physical abuse from his father, had received consistent love in his early years and maintained healthy relational capabilities that enabled him to respond well to treatment. James, however, experienced profound neglect as an infant when his mother abandoned him, leaving him with a disengaged grandmother. His dissociative adaptations, emotional emptiness, disengagement, and inability to connect made healing much more difficult. Neglect differs from trauma in its biological impact on the developing brain. While trauma and neglect often co-occur, neglect specifically deprives the brain of necessary experiences required for normal development. The Romanian orphanage crisis demonstrated how prolonged early deprivation leads to persistent deficits in cognition, motor skills, and relationship formation. Even as adults, these individuals struggle with employment, health problems, and social relationships. Similar cases in the United States, like Danny, the girl in the window, show how children raised in extreme neglect develop without basic social skills, appearing almost feral. The timing, pattern, severity, duration of neglect, and presence of any buffering factors all determine its impact. The most common form is chaotic neglect, inconsistent caregiving that creates an unpredictable world for the developing child, while splinter neglect occurs when specific developmental domains are deprived, as with the mother who kept her 5 intellectually advanced children physically restrained, preventing normal motor development. Even wealthy families can inflict emotional neglect when parents outsource childcare without understanding the importance of relational consistency. Just as a child needs consistent exposure to one language to develop speech properly, they need consistent caregivers to develop healthy relational capabilities. The infant brain requires repetitive experiences with a few safe, stable relationships during the first year to build the neurobiological foundation for future relationships. Our increasingly distracted society compounds this problem. Parents physically present but emotionally absent, constantly checking phones instead of engaging with their children. This partial attention sends the message, "I'm not important," to developing brains, potentially creating emotionally hungry adults with an unquenchable thirst for love. As Dr. Tronick's Stillface experiments demonstrate, even brief parental disengagement causes immediate infant distress, and chronic emotional absence can lead to lifelong feelings of inadequacy and maladaptive behaviors. The body's stress response system operates on a continuum from calm to terror. When facing inescapable threats, the brain activates dissociation as a protective mechanism. For people with trauma histories, dissociation becomes their primary coping strategy, and they often unconsciously seek familiar patterns, even harmful ones. This explains why abuse survivors frequently sabotage healthy relationships. The unfamiliar feeling of being treated well creates discomfort, leading them to provoke familiar negative responses that validate their worldview. We often use the belief in others' resilience as an emotional shield to protect ourselves from discomfort when faced with trauma. This manifests as gradually distancing ourselves from traumatized individuals, leaving them isolated precisely when support is most needed. The emotional bottom typically hits around 6 months after trauma, when initial community support has faded. Similarly, with community traumas like war or racism, privileged groups turn away from pain, using phrases like, "look how far they've come," or "they're resilient," to create distance. After traumatic events, communities initially mobilize resources, but this help is often mistimed and ignorant of trauma's realities. As time passes, people grow tired of hearing about trauma and want to focus on healing, resulting in well-intentioned but awkward gestures like memorial t-shirts or teddy bears. Children aren't born resilient like Nerf balls that return to their original shape after pressure. They're born malleable like metal hangers that permanently change when bent. While people can demonstrate and build resilience after trauma, no one emerges completely unscathed or returns to being exactly the same. Even when a child appears to function normally after trauma, there may be invisible biological changes affecting gene expression or requiring more energy to maintain previous performance levels. Resilience isn't innate, but something we can build in people. The key to developing resilience lies in connectedness to others who are present, supportive, and nurturing. Our core regulatory networks, CRNs, become stronger through controllable, predictable, moderate challenges. This process begins in infancy when caregivers meet a child's needs and continues as children explore their world with the safety of returning to their safe base. Proper dosing of challenges is crucial. They must be neither too difficult nor too easy, but just right to activate moderate stress responses that build coping capacity. Children who've experienced trauma often live in persistent fear, making seemingly moderate challenges overwhelming. Rhythm plays a vital role in regulation, whether through dancing, walking, massage, or other repetitive activities that can help regulate even those with PTSD. The journey from traumatized to typical to resilient creates a unique perspective that leads to post-traumatic wisdom. Shaka Sankor's powerful story illustrates how trauma shapes lives. Born James White to a middle-class Detroit family, he was a straight-A student with dreams of becoming a doctor. However, he endured his mother's explosive temper and physical abuse, and his parents' unstable marriage and eventual divorce led him to seek protection in street life. By 14, he was selling drugs and carrying a gun. At 19, during an argument, he shot and killed a man named David. In prison, Shaka continued his violent behavior until receiving a letter from his son that catalyzed his transformation. Since his 2010 release, Shaka has become an advocate for criminal justice reform, teaching that people shouldn't be defined by past mistakes. Dr. Perry explains how trauma creates a toxic mismatch between children's capabilities and education system expectations. Children with developmental delays and trauma symptoms get labeled hypervigilance as ADHD, medicated, excluded, and punished. Their self-regulation efforts are prohibited, leading to frustration and behavioral problems. Between 30-50% of public school children have three or more ACEs, with trauma memories easily activated by innocent classroom cues. When schools implement trauma-aware approaches like the Neurosequential Model in Education, NME, they see dramatic improvements in academic achievement and decreased behavioral problems. Effective trauma-informed schools emphasize regulation and connection before reasoning, allowing regulatory activities like movement, fidgeting, and rhythmic activities that help balance overactive stress response systems. Dr. Perry emphasizes that activities often considered elective, sports, music, and art, should be central to education because they provide regulatory, relational, and cognitive benefits that engage the whole brain, unlike passive classroom lectures where children sit motionless in rows. Effective healing involves using healthy relationships to revisit traumatic experiences in controlled ways. While therapists can be valuable, they aren't required for healing. Having access to caring people is actually a better predictor of good outcomes than therapy alone. The therapeutic web of positive relational opportunities throughout one's day is crucial, ideally including connectedness to family, community, and culture. Dr. Perry recounts his transformative experience with a Maori community in New Zealand, where he discovered a holistic approach to healing that emphasized wānanantanga, reciprocal relationships creating connection and belonging. The elders valued Western medicine, but believed it missed the core element of health, connectedness. Returning from New Zealand, Dr. Perry began focusing on the relational health of his patients. 10-year-old Timothy, diagnosed with ADHD and ODD, had experienced physical abuse from ages 3 to 6, followed by poverty and frequent moves. Despite being 10, his social development resembled that of a 5-year-old due to trauma and limited social opportunities. His best friend was a boy he'd met once at a campground. Rather than continuing ineffective medication, Perry's team enrolled Timothy's depressed mother in treatment, found Timothy a school mentor, connected him with a Boys and Girls Club, and helped his mother find a church community for single parents. 6 months later, both mother and son were thriving. Timothy had no behavior problems, improved academically, and made real friends. Their healing came through building positive relationships and a sense of belonging. Human brains evolved for 250,000 years in small hunter-gatherer bands of 60 to 100 people with diverse age groups living in close proximity. Our sensory systems developed to monitor natural rhythms and social cues within these intimate groups. Modern life, with its rapid technological changes, bombards us with sensory overload, urban environments, artificial light, processed foods, and constant exposure to strangers. This taxes our stress response systems as our brains continuously assess safety. The problem is especially acute for those experiencing economic insecurity. Perry notes that household sizes have dramatically shifted. In 1790, 63% of households had five or more people, while today, 60% have two or fewer. Combined with excessive screen time, over 11 hours daily, declining family meals, and fading conversational skills, these changes have produced a more anxious, depressed, and less resilient population. Dr. Perry advocates for developing techno-hygiene rules, social practices governing technology use, similar to how we developed hygiene protocols after understanding bacteria and disease. He recommends no phone zones, screen time limits, and proper dosing of technology, especially for young children. Our visually biased brains are captivated by colorful, moving screen content, which can prevent infants and toddlers from exploring their world through all senses.